Hello and welcome to News Club. I'm your host Em, and this is where we talk about the news and what to do about it. Today I'm joined by Debs, Tom and Sneakrit, all fantastic people with fantastic thoughts, ideas and news to bring to you. They've all spoken on our podcast before, and that reminds me to remind you that you should definitely check out all the episodes. They're out now. We've had fantastic discussions, brilliant insights, definitely something you don't want to be missing. And stick around for today because we will be delving into collective non-payment as a tactic. What does it mean to take back our water to recreate the commons? After a break, we'll get into the media blitzkrieg. What that is, what that looks like, fucking media hygiene, and the fact that we really have to get on that. And once again, we'll have another break before we're joined by Chivers towards the end, who, I mean, I say that as though he's not already here, but he will end the episode by talking on the Birmingham bin strikes and, yeah, striking, all of that. What the fuck is happening? But let's get into it. So, Debs, how are we taking back our water?
Yeah, so the thing I wanted to talk about today is a campaign that I think has just launched because it says on its website from the 1st of April. So I think it's just started. It's called Take Back Our Water. And it's basically trying to get people to say that they're not going to pay their water bills because we're seeing massive price hikes, average price hikes of around 30%. I don't know about you, but my bill's gone up from like 600 a year to 800 a year. And this is in a context where the private water companies that provide water to our houses are not doing the absolute basics. They are pumping sewage into our rivers. They're giving an incredibly bad service. There's obviously been a lot of coverage of this, but yeah, just some like little statistics from a campaign called Surfers Against Sewage. In 2023, there were over 600,000 discharges of raw sewage into the UK waterways, and 75% of UK rivers pose a serious risk to human health. So this is clearly a really unacceptable situation. And then at the same time, these companies are asking us to pay more for water, which is obviously like an essential thing for life. And really, this is like the story of what's been going on our water system is the story of privatization. We used to have water provided by public companies, and they were privatized under Margaret Thatcher. And the idea with that was that the story that they said at the time was that they would become more democratic because people would become shareholders. And then as shareholders, they would hold the companies to account, or they would ensure a good service. But that's not what's happened. They've ended up being owned by, you know, massive hedge funds and these really big corporations who've sucked billions and billions of pounds out of them and given them out as like shareholder dividends to people who are already very wealthy. And then they haven't invested in the infrastructure. So part of the reason that we're seeing so many of these sewage discharges is because, you know, the infrastructure is just kind of creaking, like the pipes are not functioning well. They need a massive overhaul. And also our weather systems are changing because of a little thing called climate change. So as you will have noticed, we keep having like the wettest May on record, followed by the driest June, and then the wettest July. And this kind of pattern of surging water means that you actually need a better infrastructure to deal with it. So often when they're putting sewage into the rivers, it's because they haven't built an infrastructure that can deal with the kind of like heavy rainfall that we're having now. And so, yeah, I guess I wanted to talk about this campaign, Take Back Water, because obviously this is like awful. It's awful that we're basically being asked to pay for it as well. And what this campaign is doing is asking people to pledge to not pay their water bills. They've had nearly 10,000 people sign up so far. And this is kind of part of a tactic which has been used at various times of like getting a big group of people to say, we're not going to pay altogether. Because if one person just doesn't pay, then their water might get cut off, or they might, you know, get pursued through the courts or whatever. But if like a million people don't pay, suddenly you're kind of protected because there's so many people around you, it'd be very difficult to take action against all of those people at once. And we do have examples in history of when this has worked. On the Take Back Water website, they talk about poll tax, which was basically a change that happened. It was proposed under Thatcher in like 1989, 1990, for what eventually became council tax. And they were going to do it as the poll tax. It was going to be a flat rate for every person. So this obviously would mean that richer people would end up actually kind of paying less. It was very, very unpopular. And there were lots of different things that happened around that. There were big protests, there were riots, but also there was a campaign of non-payment. And lots of people were like, well, I'm just not going to pay this charge when it comes in. And actually, you know, the riots are the things that are often talked about and often remembered, but the non-payment was the thing that really showed how much support the rioters had, and how this was actually just a genuinely very, very unpopular thing. And it was basically the thing that led to Margaret Thatcher stopping being prime minister, being sort of kicked out. And then when John Major came in, he changed the poll tax. We've had more recent examples of people trying to use this tactic. I have this memory that, like, before Extinction Rebellion, think the Rising Up, the thing which was like pre-Extinction Rebellion, I think they had a whole idea of like getting people to pledge to do something, but only if a certain number of people would do it. We've also had this Don't Pay campaign a couple of years ago around energy bills, when all the energy bills were being, the prices were being hiked. And again, that was a like, okay, if a million people sign up to this, then we will all do a mass non-payment. I think they had 200,000 people sign up. And then actually there were some changes in the support that was being given and the price cap and stuff. So the, it didn't go ahead, but it did show kind of something of the strength of feeling. I actually think collective non-payment with water might be more successful than with energy, because basically, because the water companies are in a more precarious situation. Like, actually, these companies are very, very laden with debts. And so not receiving money from customers, from a large number of customers, could actually be something which has a really big financial impact on them and leads to them going to the government and saying, we need your help. So it could actually be a route towards taking it back into public ownership. But I also think that maybe it's something that needs to be combined in the way the poll tax riots and protests all combined with this non-payment. It might need to be combined with some other tactics, which are a bit more about just really like raising the profile of it, doing something a bit more kind of spectacular and attention grabbing. Because although we have had news coverage of the state of our rivers and seas, and, you know, there hasn't been this kind of, it's not like a sustained media story. So doing some things which could sort of put it on the agenda more consistently might be something that makes this like a more successful campaign.
I'm quite curious also actually about how the privatized infrastructure that we have presently in England, how that differs from Scotland, because it's not to say that just because it's in public ownership, it's necessarily like the best approach to how we manage water and take back our water. What's the difference really between public and private? How do we go beyond that?
Well, I think that's a really good point. And it is definitely true that some of the criticisms that people had of public bodies in like the 70s and 80s, they had a truth to them. The thing is that the private version that we've got since then has not been better. It's been worse. But I think there's a campaign group called We Own It, and they talk a lot about 21st century public services. They talk about actually needing to create these other kinds of models where, yeah, it's not just like the state is doing this thing for you, but actually you have much more kind of public involvement and participation, and people actually getting to be part of decision making around, you know, how you want to invest your money, what your priorities are. You know, imagine if people, you know, in South Yorkshire where I live, you know, Yorkshire Water wasn't just this, either this private company or run by the state, but actually people in Yorkshire could like elect people to a body that would then make decisions but also communicate with people, and then we could actually be trying to deal, because some of these things, there are some, they are genuinely difficult problems. Like, we don't actually really know very well how to deal with the patterns of rainfall that we're having here. So we're actually going to need, I think, to be a lot more creative and maybe to be learning from other places in the world where they're, this is what their rainfall has always been like. So maybe they know what to do about it. So yeah, I do think that like thinking beyond just going into back into public ownership is absolutely right. And there is some really interesting thinking about how to do that.
I was going to just add to that. I think the thing that's also really tricky with our water companies, I mean, I don't really think that privatization of any of these things works well, because the whole competition myth. But with what we have in England at the moment, we have private companies, but the whole purpose of this kind of free marketplace is that you're supposed to have competition. And with water companies, there is no competition. You don't have the option. Again, don't like privatization, but I think an example of something where you can see that there is some sort of flexibility is like energy bills at the moment. We have private energy companies, but they have the choice of green tariffs. We also have things like community energy coming in different councils, especially up in the north. You've got community owned solar panels and wind farms. So there's been this kind of shift into people owning their own energy, but also having that flexibility to switch to things that they prefer. Whereas with, I have United Utilities here in Manchester, horror show. You can't contact them. There's no way to even go through customer service. I was just looking at, there's a site called boycottwaterbills.com, which actually has some more specific instructions as to how to go through the process of cancelling your water bill and how to protect yourself as well. So that might be a good thing to share alongside it. Obviously, a lot of people don't want to pledge to cancel, also don't want everyone to get bailiffs around. So there's a few steps that people can take to protect themselves with that as well.
Am I correct in saying that during what I'll call the poll tax rebellion, on a pragmatic level, it was very difficult to actually just chase people? And the kind of tactics that were adopted to essentially kind of overwhelm the state and its agents to definitely make it difficult for people to essentially get chased up on. What did that look like, and how might we see that present day?
I mean, you're definitely challenging the level of detail of what it was like in 1989 to pay your bills. I mean, I was 5, so I wasn't really thinking about it. But
and you weren't taking action.
I know.
Absolutely.
Your silence was deafening.
But you're absolutely right that, like, we obviously have a really different relationship with the state in terms of, like, just how much they know about us, how easily they can track us down. I think there were a set of ways that people could, but at the same time, we also have different ways of being able to communicate with each other. In so many ways, it's just incredible with the poll tax that there was this, that people even, they got the word out. Because, you know, I'm assuming that, for example, the, like, mainstream newspapers were not on board with this. They were not, like, putting the word out and saying, you know, here's step-by-step instructions for not paying your rates. So yeah, I guess it's also a sign. I think it's always good to remember that activist movements and kind of forms of resistance and rebellion, they did know how to, like, talk to each other and get ideas around before the internet existed. But what we can do now, I think, is actually react much more quickly and assemble large groups of people to take action together. I think what you're saying is that there is a level of risk to this. Like, you could end up, it could affect your credit rating. It could be something that potentially you end up going through court systems for. And I suppose that's also why the scale of the thing is really important. 10,000 people is probably not enough for it to be effective, but, like, 200,000 people would probably make a big difference.
The whole point of collective action, right? It's like, not the Area 51 raid. They can't stop all of us. But considering how poor they are at responding to anything that you have as an issue when you're an actual customer, I think there's good hope in having, like, a lot of people not paying at the same time.
What are YouTubers? What were you doing back in the day?
Not being born yet is what I wasn't doing. But I know from my parents who went to the big poll tax marches in London, the ones that eventually devolved in, you know, you've got the old TV footage of the van, police vans going down the streets and people, you know, turned into a really huge, like, in places, violent act of civil disobedience and mass collective action. I think what the crucial difference with poll tax resistance was that it was much easier back then because it was levied on individual people. It was easier to just say, well, prove I live here. Prove that this house has so many people in it, and therefore the poll tax needs to be, there are 5 people in this house, or there is 1 person in this house. So the resistance, I mean, if you can imagine a society when there wasn't a massive data chain of everywhere you've lived and everyone who lives there, and how to track you down and how to take your money and how to block your accounts. Obviously, things are very different today. And I think that's part of what makes the resistance and rebellion around water extra difficult, but also even more important, is because, you know, it's really scary for, when you think about what people are cutting back on in a cost of living crisis, they start off with, you know, the silly basics like coffees and trips out. Then they start turning the heating down. Then they start buying less food. And really, it tends to be sort of water and rent are the last two to go, because then it's like, okay, well, now I'm just living in a kind of Neolithic setting where I don't have food, warmth, or shelter. So,
okay, let's not cast aspersions on the Neolithic. People had
no, okay, I mean, you know, for tens of thousands of years, they had some kind of functioning society. So something worked back then. I don't know quite what, because I wasn't born then either. I wasn't alive in the poll tax riots, and I wasn't alive for Neolithic period. So I'll leave representatives from that period to make their own case. I think what's really interesting also about the water stuff is, yeah, it's coming to that point of, like, can't pay, won't pay. and the scale of costs and hardship that people are facing, and the way that the rising tide of the cost of living crisis is, you know, drowning more and more people. You know, it used to just be it's the really, really vulnerable who are suffering from this, and now it's people who were otherwise relatively comfortable or felt that they were stable in paying their bills. I think what's also interesting is the way that the connections between things like how privatization of water has failed, the sewage being pumped into our water systems, the massive bonuses that are paid out to these companies, in a sense of, like, you know, people are getting still millions and millions of pounds of bonuses for running companies that are failing. And the best the Labour government can do is say, well, we'll ban bonuses if they're not doing good enough. Like, if they still keep polluting the waters, then maybe they don't get their bonuses. Rather than a sense of, like, maybe there shouldn't be bonuses at all for people running a water company. Maybe privatisation and competition in water isn't something that should be rewarded. Maybe that money could be going somewhere else. I don't know. I don't run water companies, but that feels like a better way to run things. So it's just that sense that when the issue of water bills, maybe when finally, ironically, the dam bursts, right, on the cost of living crisis, where people recognise this is just something I can't afford to pay. It's absolutely scandalous what's going on with my money, what privatisation has done, what ecological damage is doing, the fact I can't pay for it. So there's a really interesting sense of, like, the way that the overlapping publicity around what's happening with the water companies could be far more effective and more helpful to these kind of collective resistance campaigns than we may have seen in other spaces.
So how are we going to do it, guys? How are we going to pledge? What should we do? What are the next steps?
Well, I mean, on the Take Back Water website, you can pledge and you can add your name. Obviously, Sneakrit was just saying, if you want to actually see the steps towards it, you can go on, what was it called? Boycott Water Bills.
boycottwaterbills.com. Yes, they have a 9-step process.
Amazing. What is the process? What are the 9 steps?
My God, they're quite long. Well, it's essentially about making sure that you're covered in writing about different parts. So one of the things that they suggest on here is you cancel your payment, but you then go through the process. Basically, water companies have, it's going to get really in depth, water companies have 2 aspects to their bill. One is the water they provide to you. The other part is wastewater. And the wastewater and the sewage is what we're continuing to pay more and more of because they keep polluting everything. So cancel your direct debit, then make a complaint to your water company. They have a template on the website. You can tell them that you cancelled the direct debit. You can ask for your bills to be issued by post with how much you're being charged for incoming water, how much you're being charged for wastewater, which means that they can't pursue for debt collection whilst you have an open bill outstanding. Then the water company is legally obligated to respond within 10 days. If you're not satisfied, you can inform the water company that you want to take it to the Consumer Council of Water, otherwise known as the CCW. Then if you're not satisfied with that response, you're entitled to apply for adjudication to the Dispute Resolution Ombudsman, which is a recent thing that's just happened. And then if you're not satisfied with that, you can complain to Ofwater. Ofwat. And then at the end of the process, if you feel obligated to pay, you can pay, or you can continue to boycott and or start the entire process all over again. But doing this over the course of a couple of months, whilst more and more people are boycotting as well, that's a large period of time for them to have no money coming in at the same time.
Fantastic.
Like you say, it's kind of playing them at their own game of, like, we know how terrible their customer service is. We know how terrible it is to try and communicate with them about anything. When you need something, they will not communicate with you. So now you're like, well, okay, let's see how long it takes you to pursue this thing about me not paying my bill. And let's see how long it takes you if you also are trying to do that with, like, 20,000 other people in my area at the same time.
Yeah, I think that's core to a lot of these things, is so much of the kind of brutalizing and punishing bureaucracy that goes around things like debt collection or unpaid bills or county court judgments and all these little bits and pieces that exist to scare you into paying for things you can't afford. It is that overwhelming the system they've tried to create to scare you into paying bills, I think, is what's core of this campaign. And possibly what needs to be part of the sort of the way we talk to other people, encouraging them to get involved, is not like go into your back garden and turn off the water lever and sit there until someone nationalizes water. It's about exposing the massive failed systems that have been put in place to try and direct you into paying for a service that isn't doing a public good and is exploiting your basic necessity, your basic need for water. Yeah, I mean, more power to this campaign, and I will be looking into signing up. I'm in a weird position where, because I live in a block of flats, my water bill is tied to my service charge. So I don't have, like, a direct connection with how much water I'm using, which on a basic consumer level is good because I can just keep the taps running all day, every day, waste hundreds of litres of water for no purpose.
Don't you do wastewater as well?
I was actually thinking about this, like, from understanding, like, in Scotland, people use more water but pay less than people in England. Like, how do you encourage a culture of people not wasting water? Because, like, on a personal domestic level, I'm terrified of wasting water. Like, I grew up in that turn all the lights off, really, when you brush your teeth, you do not leave the tap running. You use the water, you know what I mean? Because you kind of have that, like, third world mentality, not to be politically incorrect or anything, but...
It's a responsible mentality.
None of us three are going to correct you on that.
You're just reclaiming it. It was a radical term.
None of us are going to step in and go, actually.
But yeah, I guess, like, because on a personal level, I have that mentality, but then I obviously can appreciate that that's not how a lot of people live. So where do we coincide here with this desire to, like, on the individual level, to a certain extent, be mindful, but also, like, really hold to account the fact that that is incomparable to the wastage and the sewage and the horrific polluting of our own country planet?
It's difficult, isn't it? Because, like, what we've seen increasingly from energy and water companies is they adopt that same language. Right, they're saying, oh, really sorry, we have to raise your bills, there's nothing we can do about it. But you can do something by cutting down on how much you use your heating or not running the tap while you're brushing your teeth. And it's like, well, yeah, those are responsible things to do in a grand sense of why would you waste stuff that's costing you money and is a, you know, valuable ecological resource. But also it's very, very difficult to not accept that sort of greenwashing, water washing PR from the companies themselves while also realizing I should be doing that anyway.
Yeah.
Again, it's about kind of changing the way we talk about them away from being a service, like a private commodity that we're buying into and we have to be responsible about it, to just always asserting these are things that are essential to our lives, they're public resources that should belong to all of us, and the responsibility has to go hand in hand with not being exploited.
Yeah, and more than just being, like, talking about it as a public resource, it's a commons. It falls literally everywhere, and then and it is essential to life, and it's not just essential to humans, it is essential to all of the life around us. And what we've seen is this process of enclosure where someone has said, oh, here's this thing that was, which you were in relationship with before, right? Like, it wasn't just this thing, it wasn't just a resource, right? It was like a thing that's like you take care of it because you understand that it is the basis of life. And then someone else is like, okay, now this is a commodity and I'm going to put a fence around it and I'm going to make you pay for it. And now your relationship to that responsibility is just in terms of like, well, how much money do you have? And so, yeah, I think for me, when we own it, talk about this kind of creating these new structures for governance, that also implies like a different relationship that people have where you're then thinking, yeah, not wasting water in the sense of I understand that this thing is precious and I understand that it needs to be shared. And I understand that especially with the changing weather, like we have to be really careful about how we're sharing this thing, and also not just with the humans, but with the non-humans that also rely on it. And that's what commons is.
My first thought was aliens. I was like, yeah. Yeah, you're right. It's collective ownership. When you own it collectively, then you have a responsibility to look after it collectively. But what you have at the minute is people charging you out the arse for things and then telling you not to be so wasteful. It's like being told to be thrifty in a situation where you've robbed me. So it definitely feels like it's not the tone that you want to be focusing on at the moment, I guess.
So let's recreate the commons. I love it. And it was at this point that we should have had a break. So here's the break.
That's the kind of thing that you should love, right? Activism isn't a legitimate thing to love. It's something you do for some other reason, right? Some high moral reason, like a task or a job, or just because you're trying to be a good person. I think it's because it can't be commodified, right? Rock climbing can be commodified. Like, there's this great documentary, The Century of the Self. It's a three-part series. It changed my life. I can't believe they showed it on BBC in like the mid-90s. And in it charts like the rise of the hippie movement and how it birthed individualism. And what they said is in the 80s, what you saw was an explosion of extreme sports. They tapped into the individualistic mindset. And these were people who would be swing voters. And they said the way to make them feel like they were leading fulfilling lives before would be to be active parts of their communities that were in some way leading them and creating change, right? And so they're like, how do we crush the trade union movements? How do we crush community movements, communists, etc.? Partially was repression, right? But partially was bribing them, was buying them off. You can be a fully actualized human being, because you can skate, snowboard, surfboard, climb, play an instrument, do art, whatever it is. And guess what? There's always another thing to buy. There's always a nicer pair of skateboarding shoes or a better deck, or you could get a better design on your skateboard. There's always like better rock climbing gear or like better carabiners or like, you know, better outdoor wear. Even though these things are essentially about quote unquote escaping the world and they're anti-consumerist, all of them became consumerist. And so you were constantly, you were like everyone else in this sort of this cycle, you know, this spinning wheel, this rat wheel, where you were constantly chasing. Like, and the thing is, even when you weren't spending money, you were always trying to get better. I did a 3.2 climb the other day. I'm going to see if I can do a 3.4, or there's this really gnarly one I could do here. I've done an ollie. I want to be able to do a kickflip. There's always something more to do. And so now, 40 years later from that explosion, when we think about loving something or having a passion, we can only think of those things that have been commodified as something that you love. Like, that's what's crazy. And you and I have internalized that. It's only in recent years that I've gone, activism's just the thing that I love doing. I'm like not doing it for any other reason. And once you realize that it's basically that thing that's above your hobby, your passion, that you love doing. And now I'm going to do the same as him. Like rock climbing, he's always finding a new place to climb, entering competitions, training for this, getting ready for that. Same here, baby. I'm in the activist gym. I'm getting my, you know, my activist muscles buff. I'm getting some mad skills to bust out on the next, you know.
The next demo.
Yeah.
And now back to the podcast. Well, following the recreation of the Commons, let's hear about the media blitzkrieg and what the hell that is. Tell me more.
It is a term that has been made up by a friend of mine. So the idea, it's very much the flooding the zone approach to media that we're seeing at the minute. I think when we were looking at stories for this week, I mentioned before the show, I had like six different news articles sent to me this morning that were all absolutely horrifying. We've got the Trump tariff situation that's just like flooded the news with hundreds of charts of various different things, and it's changing constantly. We've also had Trump saying that they're essentially not going to follow the guidance of the Supreme Court when it comes to returning US citizens from El Salvador and referring to them as terrorists, which is a very, very significant marker in terms of all the checks and balances aren't really there anymore. So what does that mean? We've also this morning had an article that the UK Supreme Court is going to define what a woman is, which is going to be a whole new culture war that comes in and kicks off. And then at the same time, we've got shit in our water. Scotland's had wildfires for like a week. There's a lot happening at the minute. So it was difficult to pick like one story to focus on. But I was looking through a few different articles around the kind of weaponizing of chaos and overwhelm that we're seeing, not just in relation to Trump and the US and his kind of actual political strategy of do so many insane things all the time so that people can't respond. But also it feels like our mainstream media is attempting to push people into a state of like analysis paralysis. So yeah, there's a lot of different terms for it. There's like, yeah, flooding the zone. There's like overwhelm. There's something that's like distract and divert or something like that. And then also the term that my friend Davey Moo uses, which is media blitzkrieg. So I guess I wanted to talk through that a little bit.
Sounds fantastic.
One of the things that I've seen a lot more of recently is, especially on social media, a lot of creators trying to take a bit of a step back from covering every news story. Obviously, the mainstream news cycle is 24 hours. There's constantly new things coming out. There are a number of like social media creators on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube Shorts that will do like headlines constantly. And myself and a few people who I speak to quite a lot used to do a lot more of these like timely articles and coverage talking about like recent things that have been reported. And almost everyone who I speak to has had to strip that down and really prioritize what they're speaking about, partly for themselves, for their own kind of ability to continue speaking on issues and not just completely burn themselves out and become useless, but also for our audiences. Because I've found recently that whenever you talk about something terrible that's happened, if you don't have an action for someone to take at the end of it, you just get hundreds of people people saying, God, this is awful. And a lot of people are very scared right now. There's a lot of people who are being targeted more publicly, more blatantly than they used to. And it's very, very easy for people to just sort of fall into this sense of ruminating and being completely unable to take any kind of action. So I wanted to sort of ask you guys as well, in terms of your own media hygiene, obviously we're all talking about politics quite a lot of the time. We're all talking about media. I found that going to like specific independent news sources for specific issues is really important, or even on social media, following specific creators who talk about a specific issue and using them as like more of a voice for things that I care about has helped. I've also found that trying to limit how frequently I check the headlines has been helpful. So just getting like all of the shit out of the way at the beginning of the day, focusing in on a couple of things that I might be able to help on. But I've also found that focusing on smaller scale issues where you feel like you can make an impact, for example, like you said, Debs, with the boycotting the water bills, or with supporting groups like Youth Demand, who were dealing with that horrendous treatment by the police last week, and actually still are. People are getting things confiscated constantly. They're being kind of terrorized by the police at this point. Yeah, trying to kind of hone in on smaller issues that you feel like you can actually make some kind of movement on has been helpful. But I wanted to ask you guys as well, what are you doing to build resilience in yourselves, to manage your media hygiene, to avoid the blitzkrieg?
Chivers, how do you respond to the analysis paralysis?
I sort of don't, which is really worrying. I think thinking through like what is my actual daily media consumption, it's far too much and far too kind of, it's like background noise constantly ongoing. So I think I'm definitely like one of these people that needs to find an alternative to it. I was I did a sort of talk for some sixth form students the other week on like the history of media and what the media is and how it works. And I made the point in there, which of course was completely alien to them, that even as recently as 15 years ago, or maybe 20 years ago, the news was something that happened once a day, right? You had the newspapers that came out in the morning with their headlines and their stories for the day. You had the 6 o'clock news. You maybe had some radio bulletins that were just repeating whatever had happened in the newspapers or on the bulletins. And then that was it. And you didn't get any more news until the next day. And it was the job of journalists to kind of scurry around and decide, what's the most important thing? What's the priority? What do I need to talk about? And obviously we know that like all of the systemic biases and structural failings of the media meant that what they chose to talk about and how they chose to talk about it was shit and bad. But in the basic sort of at the level of consumption, like how we as citizens were engaged with the media, it was a much more hands-off separate approach, mm-hmm. which obviously had different power dynamics to it because it was something that was done to you rather than something you were involved in. But on like a basic psychological and emotional level, it was probably a lot healthier, right? Because unless you were unfortunately one of the many marginalized groups that were constantly being defamed, introduced and brutalized in the media, sort of it was something that was just there on the side rather than, as it is now, something that is literally part of your interactions every sort of 30 seconds, 2 minutes, however often you check your phone, which clearly for me is too much. How to get around it, I think, is obviously cutting back, recognizing that when Trump is making statements about tariffs, they're not going to be any different in 30 seconds time or 5 minutes time or even in a week's time. This idea of like media blitzkrieg is really interesting because I think the media have definitely jumped, and I mean the media in like an institutional sense, like the profession of journalism has loved latching onto the minute by minute changes in stories without ever seeking to provide explanation, justification, context, reasoning, taking even one step back on a story. So I think there's an element there in, like, as you were saying, checking the news once, stepping away. And if you want to think about it, just like thinking through yourself of like, what does this story mean for me? Why is it important? Why do I think the media have picked up on this story and how it's being reported? And then in 6 hours time or 12 hours time or the next day, then coming back and saying, well, how has it evolved? And often you'll find that like, if you did like a comparative experiment of someone who's following the news every 30 seconds and someone who's following the news once a day, they'll probably come out with the same pieces of information, but the person who's been following it every 30 seconds is like Tweak from South Park, where they're just constantly shaking and juddering and go, oh my God, the world's about to blow up, everything's shit, we're all going to die, we're all going to die, and then nothing has really changed afterwards. Yeah, it's a lot of sort of, I don't want to say personal responsibility, but like personal choice, personal like self-care of just recognizing that this horrible little device in your hands is not benefiting you, and you're sort of helping to shore up the laziness of modern journalists, where they're like, well, my job isn't to go out and discover and interrogate facts and provide context and explanation. My job is to just say, breaking, Trump said another thing. Breaking, he said the opposite. And like, there's barely 2 seconds between the two statements. So yeah, this is a challenge to me and lots of other people. Read less news, but do more with the news that you're reading. in your own mind and like think about it more and be more critical on it.
I was just gonna, yeah, that's absolutely fantastic. I think the that idea of like drill into the stories that you can act on or you can do something about, but also like I think it's very easy for people to go like, it's always been a sort of privileged, a lot of people will say like, you've got the privilege to switch off. Some people have the privilege to switch off. Like I could make my life very easy by not caring about politics and going around being a white lady and ignoring it until it eventually comes to bite me, which it will. But it's not just about like self-care or like preservation from that side. Media companies make money off your eyeballs and your attention span. The Daily Mail is losing revenue on its print publication. It's making money on its online advertising from people reading stories that outrage them and keep them engaged. It's an easy play for them. On the other side of that, you can't be a successful, you can't be a successful citizen in terms of activism, in terms of being sustainably engaged in things if you burn yourself out. So I think that's also an important distinction to make, is like, don't switch off because you don't care. Like, don't make it so that you're unbothered about what's happening, but like making sure that you're, I see it more as like slow and steady, keeping yourself engaged, but in a more conscious way, which I think you put brilliantly there, Tom.
And I think it partly links through to the broader ideals of media reform, because switching off for the sake of switching off, like you say, is very tempting and it's easier for some people than others. What I often get when I'm like talking about media reform is people come back and say, well, we don't necessarily need to change the media because you can just stop reading the Daily Mail. You don't have to go to their websites. You don't have to read The Sun. I think, well, that's true on an individual level, but that doesn't stop those outlets from existing. That doesn't stop those outlets from harming the people, you know, from still publishing hundreds of articles a year about, you know, the alien threat from Muslims and immigrants and climate protesters. Like the groups that have always been attacked and harmed by large corporate media will continue to be attacked and harmed by large corporate media, whether you're reading them or not. So it's that distinction between, yes, switching off and stepping back and drilling in deeper, and particularly like recognizing that the media landscape we have doesn't provide much of an opportunity in itself for us to digest and explore and explain the news. We have to do that ourselves, right? A lot of the responsibility for understanding what's going on in the world has now been deferred onto us. Not that it was ever successfully done by mainstream journalists, but like that's what they say their ideal role is. Like, oh, don't you worry about the news, because we're here as professional journalists. We can interpret all the facts.
We're very balanced.
We're very balanced. We give you everything you need to know. So don't you worry your pretty little head about reading the news, because as long as you read our paper or read our bulletins, we'll get everything sorted. There's like switching off on like a mental health reason to give yourself a greater critical perspective, but still recognizing that, like, and that's part of the reason why I think stepping back and drilling into stories much more is useful from a media reform perspective, because in drilling down to the stories, you start to recognize more of those biases and failures and corporate sort of structural harms that are done by large media corporations, and finding some way to do something about it while also protecting your own basic needs to a useful and not blitzkrieg news environment.
Not to blow my own trumpet, but this conversation is making me feel like I'm very hygienic. Like,
well.
Yeah, I actually really don't look at news headlines. The ways that I engage with news is through email, through some email lists like the Canary or like a couple of local ones. Actually, I listen to a lot of podcasts, and I think so my engagement with American news is mostly through podcasts from the US, like In Bed with the Right, which I think is really great, the Conspirituality podcast, Hard Fought podcast, like ones which are, they will be talking about a news thing, but they won't be responding to it like in the moment. It might be a week or two after the news event, and they've had a little bit of time to process it, and they are trying to put it a bit more in context. And then when I want to know what's happening in the mainstream media, I will listen to Navarro Live, but I'll listen to it on 1.5 speed and kind of skip over the men.
Viable.
I love it. I listen to everything on 1.5 speed. I think it's the only way. In a similar fashion, I'd like, yeah, no, I think for the longest time I did the whole thing of like, just don't want to engage with the news, don't want to do it, don't want to do it, don't want to do it. And to be perfectly honest, I think the most I engage with it is when I, you know, listen to you guys talk and I'm like, wow.
So but I do think this, you know, the whole idea with News Clubs is that we're trying to create these collective spaces. And I think that is really, really important. Like the other route for my news is through activist WhatsApp and Signal groups. Yeah. And often I will hear about a news event from a protest. And I think that's actually, that does feel a lot less shit. because there is an action attached to it. And even if you can't always make it or support the thing, sometimes you're like, oh, I can give them some money, or yeah, I can pass this on to some other people, or something which makes you feel a bit less like, yeah, it's just a thing that is happening to you. I think there's something interesting culturally happening. I don't know how much you guys feel this as well, but I've definitely noticed that it seems much less socially acceptable, and I think for good reason, to just start a conversation with like, oh my God, did you hear about this terrible thing that's happened? Feels like there is a bit more of a culture of checking in of like, how engaged are you feeling able to be right now? And I think that's a good practice. And at the same time, I do think it's important for us to find each other at those moments when we are really feeling really activated or feeling like, yeah, I need to not be alone with this. I need to not be sitting here scrolling on my phone and sort of in some ways feeling connected to this wider world, and in other ways feeling like as isolated as it could be. So yeah, I guess this is the whole idea with News Clubs, of like how to create a space where people have all agreed and consented that right now we're going to talk about the news, and but we're also going to be, yeah, sharing those feelings and trying to find a way to do something a bit more productive with them than like just screaming in our bedrooms.
I really like what you said there in terms of almost receiving news from the people around you, like not actually because you've seen the big headline, but because someone has said to you, this is actually valuable and we can actually do something about that. I think to me, that's what this podcast is in many ways. It's like, oh wow, like now I can shout at all my English friends and tell them to like go not pay their water bill, right? Because it means I'm necessarily like in communication and in community with someone somewhere at some point. It transforms how I'm relating to the news. And I like it because I don't like the news. I love listening to you guys.
I think it's also, yeah, it's like, it's that point of, I really like what Tom said about step back and kind of lock in on the wider strategy. I think those are the two points that are really big for me. One, do it when there's an action. But two, looking at individual news stories all the time is pointless if you're not connecting the dots between what's happening. I punch my microphone. Like, because you can, people will continue.
It's a very powerful point. You needed to punch the microphone.
Listen, because it's like when you have these culture wars coming up, like, oh, we've got a new thing to blame. We've got a new group to blame, a new marginalized group that we're going to go after and target. If you know about how moral panics work and you know about how folk devils work, then you're not surprised the next time the story comes along. And it's the same tactic again and again. Like, a lot of the strategies that we're seeing from the mainstream media have happened multiple times in the past. Looking at the news, not just as individual incidents that are constantly happening, and seeing that wider strategy and how it's impacting you, I think also can help you feel a lot more prepared for it, though not fully prepared, still quite stressed, but given the circumstances, a little bit more equipped.
So go start your news club and be more intentional about how you listen to news and have friends and stuff and talk to them.
And don't pay your water bill or your TV license. Fuck it.
I think TV license is a funny one. I feel like I know too many people that don't pay their TV license.
Allegedly.
Let's make that a specific topic.
Yeah, I have a lot to say about the TV license. Probably very unpopular things to say about the TV license in our space, but for another day.
Yes, I'm so excited. We'll have a little break moment, as we should have before, and we will come back with Chivers and your brilliant, brilliant story and information around the Birmingham bin strikes, which I know I'm going to find so riveting.
Sassed into the ad break.
Does reading the headlines ever make you feel like you're going to have a panic attack? Does it feel like an asteroid is somehow about to hit the Earth once every other week? Or that people are doing crimes in really weird ways, and it's not really gelling with your idea of reality? Or do you just feel baited? You're probably dealing with sensationalism, the next form of bias in our series. That's right, welcome back to Media Bias 101. I'm your host, Sneakrit, where we're not just talking about the fact that the media are lying to you, but the many different ways that they do it. There are two key questions when it comes to consuming content and media that apply to sensationalism. One of the questions is, why am I being shown this story in the first place? And the other is, how is this story supposed to make me feel? And the key principle that helps you understand in this context is that extreme emotions sell. When you hear about something like an asteroid coming to hit the Earth or some horrible crime that's been committed, it's like seeing a fire in your house. You're not going to be able to take the time to go, hang on a second, what does this actually mean? Let me ask these questions, because you've seen the fire, And your first reaction is just going to be to freak the fuck out. It's worse with sensationalized media because you're not just seeing one fire in your house, you're seeing fires all over the world. And if you're convinced that all of these fires are all over the world all of the time, you're going to start seeing fires everywhere. When all you see is fire everywhere, it's very difficult to think critically about what you're seeing, which is why sensationalized media is a really strong pipeline through to consuming and believing in misinformation. There's two things that you're going to do whenever you see this kind of content. Whenever you see something that prompts a heavy emotional response, the first thing is ask why you're seeing it. Who is showing it to you? What's the publisher doing? Is it something that you've seen everywhere this week? Why is it being covered so broadly? One thing you're going to do is you're going to read through the content or listen through, and wherever you see an emotional form of language or emotional tone of voice, dull it down to the most neutral, basic thing. Because often what you'll find is the stories that you're reading aren't quite as crazy as they looked when you first saw them. Stay tuned for the next part of this series, and don't forget to follow News Club UK for more.
Am I about to find out you were too young to have the old wheeling TV trays in school?
Yes.
Dear, oh dear. I'm logging off right now.
And we're back from the break. Thank you, guys. Thank you for the hate. You know what? My only reference for wheeling in TVs is like media references to wheeling in TVs, such that I'm familiar with the notion of wheeling in a TV, but has always been framed as something, I don't want to say this word, but I want to say it, ancient? It feels...
Okay, well, just say it then. Just bloody say it. Fine. Ancient. How
back
dare
in the
you?
Neolithic. The TVs were all just wheeled in.
This is going massively off topic, but I think I was in school at that moment when the transition happened from, like, the old wheeling in the old TV tray to put on a VHS tape to when schools started spending what must have been hundreds of thousands of pounds each to bring in these like fancy whiteboards where you could like write on it in a digital pen.
The digital whiteboard, and nobody
knew
how to use them.
They never ever worked. And it was like
digital whiteboard.
Yeah, so it was
like YouTube on it.
Don't tell me you didn't have digital whiteboards either. Jesus, this is going to be like the end of
News Club. I had like actual whiteboards.
You just had holograms.
Yeah. Okay, so this was like, I'm sure, you know, I don't know the story behind it. I'm sure there's some like Blair era PFI corruption behind it. But basically at one point, every school was like, these digital whiteboards are the cutting edge of technology. We've got to replace our normal whiteboards where you just have a whiteboard and a pen and a wipe with this like touch screen, an early touch screen where like you had a sort of a fake marker pen and the screen would detect where you were writing and then it would be like on the computer and you could move things. And they just never ever worked. I don't actually know how they worked because the ones I had in school never worked.
We had a projector that projected onto a whiteboard.
Yeah, yeah.
That was just a computer screen. So it was exactly the same as having just actually had a projector.
Just about to say, yeah, you've described like the classic whiteboard that was at the front of like the room that we had, and then they had to like, you know, we'd call it the game where you'd like see people, like your teacher would recalibrate it and like have to draw the lines to the middle.
Corners.
But what you've just described suggests that we, like, people had individual ones?
No. This was still the one at the front of the class.
Oh, okay, okay, cool.
That's to come next. That'll be the big Starmer reform to education, is it? An iPad tablet for every child, sponsored
AI.
By Apple.
AI
tablets, yeah.
Right, so we're going to swiftly move on from wheeling in TVs to wheeling in bins and why they're actually not being wheeled in.
Very good.
Yes, I told you there'd be a pun. I told you guys.
Oh, that was really clever.
That was very, very clever. So yes, this is the Birmingham bin strike, which has been going on since January. The actual dispute between the waste collectors in Birmingham and the local council has been going back to January. But since the middle of March, a lot of the waste collectors have been out on permanent, indefinite strike while negotiations are ongoing. Basically, what's happened is Birmingham Council declared bankruptcy back in 2023. This is off the back of, obviously, a decade and more of national government cuts to local government. So council everywhere are having less money to do more and more services. They've been raising local council tax levels, but it's nowhere near enough to substitute the money that's been taken away by national government. Waste collectors in Birmingham had already accepted a £1,000 voluntary pay cut as their sort of attempt to help the council to balance its budgets. But the council now...
Voluntary!
Voluntary. They voluntarily accepted to take pay cuts because they recognise their jobs are so essential and it's a workforce that needs to happen. And unbelievably, they've taken this heroic step to voluntarily accept a first stage of cuts. But of course, with greedy councils, they always come back for more. So they are now trying to cut their pay by £6,000 a year, which in any walk of, if you were an investment banker, you would not accept a £6,000 pay cut, let alone if you are a sort of median income bin collector in Birmingham doing an unglamorous but completely essential public service job. So I wanted to talk, I mean, obviously the strike itself is really important to support, but I think what's interesting is how the media coverage has focused almost exclusively on pictures of waste piling up on people's streets, the public health hazards from the kind of massive sort of swarm of rats that are building up around the waste piles, the risk for public health around diseases. There's lots of footage of long queues of people queuing up to take their bins to the tip themselves, in place of the weekly bin collections that aren't happening due to the strike. And in some cases, there are some quite positive stories about people in the communities coming together, helping each other out, like people taking a day on the weekend to go and help vulnerable people clear the waste off their streets and kind of, you know, people sharing cars to take lots of waste to the tips all in one go. But of course, what's completely missing from the media coverage is the perspective of the refuse workers themselves, the reasons why they're on strike, and the devastating impact that the council's proposed direct cuts to their pay would actually have on their lives, and actually what the cuts would have even on the future functioning of the bin service itself. Like, who is going to work in refuse collection if you've just seen already that their pay has been reduced by £6,000 a year? What does that tell you about the kind of conditions and respect that are given by the council to people working in this service? And I think also we've seen a lot of like really standard, and this is a Labour council in Birmingham, and they've been employing really what can only be described as like strike breaking tactics borrowed from the Thatcher era. They've been calling in the police to corral the picket lines, basically on spurious claims, which we always see, of like the council saying we needed to call in the police because the strikers were blocking the roads or intimidating people who had gone into work. And like, none of this has ever been evidence, but it's really helped to support this idea of like, strikers aren't people out for good conditions and pay. Strikers are militant yobbos who have just come in to like make a fuss and demand money for nothing. The council have also brought in really expensive agency workers, partly as scabs, but also partly as just like a way to undermine the collective bargaining position of the refuse collectors themselves in the longer term, which is unbelievable because the amount of money they're now spending on the agency workers, I imagine, is much more than it would have cost them to just settle the dispute at the current pay levels. And in a lot of the council's public communication on the strikes, they kept repeating this lie that's so often repeated across lots of strikes in public sector work, a kind of core strike-breaking tactic, which is to say striking workers should simply give up, go back to work, and pull all this nonsense to rest. And the local and national media is very happily parroted these lines from the council without a whiff of basic kind of critical analysis. Like we were talking about before, there's not been a sense of any media coverage stepping back and saying, why is this strike continuing? Why are these workers doing this? What is the sort of long-term impact for the functioning of waste collection in Birmingham? What does it tell us about the state of council finances and the basic relationship between paying for services and the people who do them?
Yeah, can you speak a little bit more about collective bargaining?
It's the essential notion behind trade unions is, if you want to try and secure your work and argue for a better wage, power is in numbers. And you come together and you say, well, all of us who work in this particular business or all of us who work in this particular public service will refuse to work or reduce the work we're doing unless all of us together have some kind of pay or conditions that we can all agree on. And it's very difficult for an employer, or it used to be very difficult for an employer, to find ways around that because their entire workforce was deciding, but unless I get the pay and conditions I want, I'm not going back to work. And this is where the strike-breaking tactics come in to undermine collective bargaining, is by bringing in agency workers, by having this media blitzkrieg around saying that strikers aren't people with jobs. Strikers are people trying to create a nuisance, trying to ruin people's lives, willingly letting waste build up in the streets because they're yobbos and nuisances, etc., etc. So that's the essence of collective bargaining, which has been undermined since the 70s in the ways that lots of public services now are increasingly reliant on agency workers. They will suddenly find money to pay agency workers when they can't find money to pay their actual staff.
I also keep thinking about good work strikes and the fact that I can't see how that translates with this particular line of work. Is there a way around of people doing the work and also simultaneously like posing a challenge?
And there have been examples of, for example, people on railways being like, well, we're just not going to enforce non-payment. And that's been that's been a really effective strategy in other parts of the world. The problem in the UK is that we have such restrictive laws around what trade unions can and can't do and when they are protected by being on strike. So if you basically, there's all of these legal frameworks, and if you follow all of the rules, then you can go on strike and you basically can't be sacked for doing that, even though, of course, they can like dock your pay. Whereas if you step outside of the rules, then they can start saying, well, now you're not performing your job, and then you can be, the union itself can start to be liable for the costs to the company or to the local council or whatever. And these rules that trade unions have to follow have got like more and more restrictive since the 1980s. And they're now like insane. It is so difficult to go on strike. And this is like why it's actually been remarkable in the last few years that we have seen this real wave of strike action, because you have to not only get, you know, when you're putting a ballot out and saying, do you want to go on strike? You not only have to get a majority of people to say yes, but you have to get a certain turnout in terms of your registered members. And there's all of these, like, it's like super boring to describe. And what it also means is that trade unions become incredibly boring places. Like the opportunity to actually talk about, so for example, with the strikes with the university and college union, so this is what academics are usually part of, you would go into a UCU meeting, and the time that it would take to just describe what had happened and all the steps that the union was taking at the national level or what your local branch was doing, whatever, it would take up the whole meeting. You would never actually get to talk about any of the substantial issues, like how changes were affecting your work or how you were dealing with management or whatever. So it's a kind of death by bureaucracy process where it's like exactly what you say, like these more creative strategies of like, well, what if we still run the trains, but we just don't make people pay for them, which means that people can still get to work. They still get the service that they want. But what we're actually harming is the bosses. That's a great tactic. And that's the sort of thing where if you were in a union meeting and someone was proposing that, you could have a really exciting conversation about it. But you absolutely cannot do that as a registered union. And so instead, what you have to have is like loads of conversations about like the precise procedures that you've gone through and like the precise timing of the ballots and has it been sent out to exactly the right people and what's the threshold for whatever. And it just becomes the most dead, boring conversation. And of course, that massively puts people off being part of unions.
So what do we do? Like, what is one of the responses we can have to like this failing over bureaucratized institution?
I mean, there definitely are these kind of newer unions that have set up in the last sort of 10 years. So things like the Independent Workers of Great Britain and UVW, which is United Voices of the World. There's a bunch of others, and they're trying to think in a much more creative way about how to organize people, particularly in sectors where, you know, the IWGB is literally for people who their work contract will be as an individual. So if you're working for Deliveroo, you're not part of an official workforce. You're just officially like a freelancer. So how do you even bring those people together or get them to like see themselves as a group? And so it's very, very difficult to organize in those spaces in some ways, but in other ways, these are the spaces that like Unison is not interested in, Unite is not interested in, like the big established unions are often like, we're not even going to try and bring those workers together. So they are not kind of restricted in the same ways by like, you know, these bureaucracies. It's both stuff that the state has imposed and it's also the cultures within these unions and the union workers. So newer unions, I think, are thinking in different ways. And also because they are often trying to organise in the most precarious parts of the economy, which have a lot of migrant workers, they're also taking strategies and tactics from other parts of the world. And particularly, you know, there's a lot of Latinx people in those unions, and there's a really different and much more, I don't know, like it's... They're both much more up for a fight in terms of like, yeah, like up for pushing the boundaries of what they can do. But I think there's also an understanding that like to make a union a space where people are actually feeling like this isn't just about boring meetings and maybe a 3% rise in my pay. This is actually about us trying to build a movement. So then they'll run like socials, they'll have big barbecues, people will bring their whole families. And this I understand as being very much like a cultural thing, largely drawn from Latin America, of like, how do you make the union basically feel more like church and then feel like something that people will actually like show up for, want to be part of, actually maybe even feel like a little bit of joy around, rather than it just being a like, here's a letter that I got in the post and here's like an extremely boring meeting that I'm gonna like have on in the background while I'm you know, cooking dinner.
I love the idea of unions bringing like carne asadas into the country. That's amazing. Let's do that. Let's do more of that. You ever had that, Jivers? You ever done that? You ever been invited?
No one invites me anywhere. I mean, even on the best of times, no one invites me to anything. I think Debs was talking there about like positive unions, and what's been also really interesting to see is the rise of other union movements which aren't necessarily connected to work, but like Acorn as a union, which is connected to sort of protecting people as citizens in basic sort of vulnerable conditions, like people in the community coming together to prevent no-fault evictions or stopping bailiffs from, you know, tearing apart people's homes on the basis of bills, which, you know, all of these weird legal traps and ways that people are punished. So, you know, there's what Debs was describing is, I think, definitely a community activist shift away from the more traditional kind of monolithic union approach. Because I think it's not necessarily, yeah, the big unions have become very bureaucratic, but that's also a reflection of what's happened to the notion of work in general, that it's not something that's a part of your life and you build communities around it and you sort of, it's so essential to the conditions of safe, healthy, prosperous living that unions are there to ensure that. It's more that work is something that you have to do to earn a living. And unless there's something going wrong with that living, unions kind of take a back seat and wait till the big disputes. Whereas the more community-focused unions recognize that, yeah, exactly those sorts of social relationships, building communities through collective action and sharing in different struggles, whether it's to do with work or whether it's to do with someone in your local community being under threat from an eviction or from bailiffs or from harmful actions of local governments, I think is, yeah, a really inspiring thing that's happened in the midst of everything else going on that seems really bad. So definitely something to do is like, get involved in unions like Acorn, consider setting up your own community union in your area and think of like, you know, even beyond labour disputes, what is going on in our community where we could bring people together and make a force to do something about it.
Fuck yeah. Would you do that, Sneaker? She's muted. She's unmuted.
Apologies. Yeah, I was thinking as you were talking, there's so many useful actions and suggestions within what both of you have spoken about there. I think a really big part of it is just kind of, yeah, building more of these sort of smaller community solidarity things. It feels like we are at a tipping point, right? Like I saw a video earlier today where someone was saying like, how are we still having people being like homophobic in the apocalypse? We're not. You're told for a very, very long time that you're scaremongering when you talk about things like pre-Brexit, when you talk about things like Trump. And a lot of things are just happening now in a very, very real and scary way. And it's no longer a case of like spending your time trying to convince people to do the right thing. It's time to like get in community and support the people around you. And I think looking at things like, yeah, fuck it, don't pay your water bill. Don't pay your water bill, because by not doing it, you're providing a buffer to all of the other people who aren't doing it and who probably can't afford to pay their water bills right now. When it comes to supporting strikers, when it comes to supporting protesters, like just using what you do have, which is like your wallet, your attention span, and your body to provide a buffer and support people in whatever way you can, I think is super important. Yeah, I feel like from the bins all the way to everything else that's happening in the world at the minute, it feels like that purpose of building like community groups and community action is going to be the only thing that gets us through on a practical level, but also like emotionally keeps us remotely, I'm not going to say like sane, but like at the level we're at and not worse. But yeah, so I think it's really cool to hear you guys kind of talking through how we can go about that in more solid ways.
So basically, My Little Pony got it right, and friendship is magic, guys. That's it. That's it.
That little pony never misses.
But yeah, speak to your mates. Don't pay your water bill. Go to the carne asada with your union friends and
invite me when you hold them. I need to go to stuff.
And invite Chivers.
I don't know. We'll hear what you've got to say about the TV license first.
I think that's partly why I'm not invited to parties anymore, because my talking pieces are like BBC reform, media legislation. Have you heard what Ofcom did recently? And people are like, he's not fucking coming again. Don't invite that guy to the next cookout, you know.
But going back to what Deb said, this is why we have to ask people, you know what I mean, and have consenting spaces where we're like, you know what, guys, today we're going to delve into this.
Next week, whether you like it or not, TV licensee discourse.
Shit, let's do it. But yeah, thank you so much, guys. I've actually really enjoyed this. I love listening to you guys. And thank you to our audience, whoever's listening, we're also listening. Crazy. And make sure to follow us on News Club. We have a newsletter coming out every week, and we have this podcast coming out every week with these brilliant, brilliant people that we can learn so much from. Thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks all.
Thank you.
All right.